This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. During his lightning visit to Baghdad earlier today, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld again denounced the abuse of Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib prison and repeated his promise to bring all of those responsible to account. So far, 9 prison guards faced courts-martial on charges stemming from Abu Ghraib. The last 2 cases were announced yesterday. Some of the accused say they participated in acts they knew to be wrong because they were ordered to do so. The military is a special case. We'll find out more about that in a moment. But at one time or another, almost all of us find ourselves in positions where we're expected to obey. At home, as kids, at school, and certainly at work. We live in a society that celebrates the individual and independent action, yet we often face situations where we're expected to be a team player and go along. So how do we decide to obey, to ignore, or to protest an order? Later in the program, the buzz on television's fall season. But first, following orders. If you've ever gotten an order you had to think 2 or 3 times about, give us a call and tell us what you decided to do and why. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now to discuss how the military thinks about following orders is Colonel Stuart Harrington. He retired from the Army, former Army intelligence officer. He joins us by phone from his office in California. And it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to join you.
The military obviously places a great deal of emphasis on the need to follow orders. That's drilled into soldiers from their first minute they step off the bus at boot camp. Are soldiers ever taught when they should and should not follow a command?
Yes, Neil, in fact, they are. Although the issue of obeying orders gets to the heart of a military's ability to function and yet is somewhat ambiguous, soldiers are taught that they must obey lawful orders, and that's the key distinction here. They're not told that they blindly follow all orders, but rather that they have to follow lawful orders, and the converse to that is that they are obliged to refuse to obey an unlawful order.
And how is that distinction made in their instructions?
I knew I could count on you to ask the right question. It's a very tricky distinction. I mean, if you think about it, soldiers are, from the moment they're inducted, taught that the mission of the military is to apply controlled or managed violence, which is usually not phrased that way, but rather in something more graphic, such as to kill and capture the enemy. So right away, soldiers or young civilians, when they volunteer, as we have a volunteer military, have this ambiguity in that they are being trained to do something which in civilian life is by definition unlawful. So it's a slippery slope. And in the training that soldiers get when they join, they get examples that try to strip away the ambiguity or at least to give them some guidance on what is and what isn't an unlawful order.
Well, for instance?
Well, a good for instance would be if your platoon sergeant says, shoot that guy, and that guy is standing about a block away with an RPG pointing at you, that's pretty unambiguous and it doesn't take, you know, it's not a major intellectual challenge to determine that you got a lawful order.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if your platoon sergeant were to say, shoot that guy, and that guy is a prisoner who's already been flex-cuffed and blindfolded, then we have the other extreme of a pretty unambiguous example of an unlawful order.
Obviously, most situations don't fall into either of those easy categories. And by the way, I assume all of this training applies to reservists and National Guard members as well?
It certainly does. You know, the Army and all of the services talk about the total force, and that includes reserve as well as active duty.
Mm-hmm.
And these subjects that we're discussing today are part of everyone's training. But that said, you're absolutely correct, Neil. What happens is, of course, you get into the gray areas of where there's something in between, and in particular in a situation where it's a combat zone and where things are urgent and people are getting hurt, young soldiers who've had their training have to make these instant judgments on whether something is lawful or unlawful, and they're frequently not able to really make that distinction very quickly. And so I would have to say that the average soldier is conditioned, as it must be, to obey orders. They know they're to obey lawful orders, but they don't have the time or the wherewithal to sit and do an evaluation of every single set of circumstances they find themselves in. So they're probably going to err on the side of obeying rather than on the side of disobeying.
Well, what happens when they do disobey?
That's the difficulty. When a soldier disobeys a lawful order, consequences develop from that that are somewhat different than, for example, if you worked for Microsoft and they told you to do something, you said, no way, I'm not going to do that. You have the democratic right to walk away and go to work for Cisco or Intel Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
But a soldier is bound by the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the oath he takes. So if he's going to disobey a lawful order, he knows that there are consequences that flow from that that can be pretty severe. Now, I must tell you that it's situation dependent, and it would depend on the order itself. It would probably depend on the circumstances, i.e. a combat zone where everyone's in harm's way versus some garrison situation. So, for example, if a soldier was told, you will be in my office at 0700, prepared to do 1 hour of rigorous physical training, and failed to show up, that soldier has disobeyed a lawful order and probably will be punished by some kind of a reprimand, written or verbal. He could receive non-judicial punishment, which is like, they call it an Article 15.
Mm-hmm.
Or in a more serious circumstance, if the soldier violated some serious order, he could be court-martialed. In any event, all soldiers know that if you disobey a lawful order, you don't have the same democratic rights that a civilian might have to just say no and walk away.
At the same time, though, that court-martial proceeding, that's certainly a threat, but isn't it also a, you know, it's going to make somebody's commander think twice about an order, because that's going to bring everything out. Maybe it was an unlawful order.
Absolutely. I mean, you may rest assured that, you know, headline events of these days notwithstanding, that most military folks are acutely aware of the need to wield their power and their authority judiciously. Most soldiers intuitively from their upbringing know things that are really, really wrong. The difficulty is when you get into stressful situations in a combat environment where the areas are gray, soldiers might make mistakes. On the other hand, some things are simply not ambiguous, and soldiers know or must intuitively know that they're wrong. And some good examples of that would be some of the shenanigans that have gone on recently in Iraq.
Mm. Let's get some listeners involved. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email TOTN at NPR.org. We'll begin with Bob in Tucson, Arizona.
My comment, I agree with what your specialist is saying there, but where a military career could live or die on an efficiency report, sometimes, no matter whether the order be right or wrong, if it's failed to be obeyed, that career could be over. So I think that has to be looked at as well.
Colonel Harrington?
I think that your listener has made a very valid point. In a hierarchical organization like the military, which is very unforgiving of people who make serious errors, that pressure is always going to be there. And that's one reason why leadership and good leadership and supervision and guidance is so important, because when unlawful orders are given and when situations like that develop, soldiers will frequently feel under that extra stress. They may even know intuitively that it's wrong, but they also are afraid that if they don't do what the old man says or what the sergeant says, that, you know, it can come back on them in many ways, and not the least of which would not be a court-martial, but rather just, you know, the kind of thing of knowing that you crossed your supervisor. So I think your listener is wise in pointing that out. All of this, of course, points to how critical it is that you have good leadership, because young soldiers will frequently not know what to do. They won't be able to differentiate, or even if they do, as your listener said, they may feel the wrong kinds of pressure. So leadership and supervision are key elements here.
Bob, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Let's go now with Joe, and Joe is on the line with us from Concord, California.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a retired military member, and I'm really appalled that anybody in the U.S. military would use the excuse, I was just following orders. Several times my career was hurt by saying, hey, I want that order in writing, or I'm not willing to do that. I don't think that's right. And, yes, I did retire a couple of pay grades lower than what I might have if I had gotten with the program, but I'm able to sleep at night, and I didn't do anything to embarrass my country or my service. And people really need to be able to take some individual responsibility, and they make me ashamed that they are in my army when they're going to use that just cowardly excuse that they were just following orders. They could have made some kind of a protest. They could have went to the IG. Yes, they could be forced to do these things, but they should have spoken to somebody, the chaplain, the inspector general, their commander, somebody else, somebody at home, their congressman, their senator. It's just terrible. That's not the American way.
IG, of course, is the inspector general. And I wanted to get a response to that, Colonel Harrington, by adding in this email we got from San Antonio, Texas, from Sally. What about military chaplains? Can't the soldiers discuss their concerns with them? As a chaplain's daughter, I know that was one of my dad's jobs. Where were the military chaplains in Iraq? Well, you may not know the answer to that last part, but broadly about chaplains.
First of all, I couldn't agree more with your caller. I'm ashamed, as he is, and I think anyone who's worn the uniform and who's been in these tough situations, which most of us have been, know that the idea that I did these heinous things, these horrific things, because someone ordered me to do it, is the worst of all possible cop-outs. I was following orders, went out with or should have gone out with Nuremberg. It's very clear to me, based on what I know about what happened in that prison, that even if some young specialist or some young sergeant from the interrogator side of the house in some way obliquely suggested to the MPs that they carry out a regime of conduct like this, the MPs didn't have to do it. And I couldn't sign on more, by the way, to the fact that there are many outlets in the military, from the chaplain right up through the IG and the chain of command, to try and put a stop to this. Although I must say, from what I've read of the Taguba report, the chain of command in the 800th MP battalion was derelict almost from, well, you know, they say the house leaks from the roof on down.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly appears to me, having read the entire Taguba report, that soldiers in that particular unit would have had a hard time getting any comfort from their chain of command. But they could have gone to the chaplain, or they could have just flat out said, no, sir, I'm not doing it. It's wrong.
Joe, thank you.
I have one other comment.
Sure.
If possible. Yeah, it seems odd to me that someone who is professional enough to say, I am willing to give my life for my country, isn't willing to sacrifice their career advantage to do the right thing. And I just want to leave it at that.
Joe, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
And an email that we got, one of several on this point, from Michael in Portland, Oregon. As you pointed out, Colonel Harrington, soldiers are trained to obey orders as this email writer puts it, to murder people. It shouldn't surprise us that they would be able to abuse people. Is that a fair statement?
No, I mean, I find that dripping with unacceptability. First of all, soldiers aren't trained to murder people. Soldiers are trained to carry out the mission, if necessary, to kill enemy soldiers in a course of combat where they are duly ordered by the National Command Authority under the laws of the nation and the laws of land warfare to carry out their mission. So, you know, to immediately set up a situation where, well, they're trained to murder people, therefore they abuse people, that's a comment that I just find drippingly unacceptable.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Stuart Harrington, retired from the Army with the rank of colonel. He was an intelligence officer in the United States Army, and we thank him very much for his time today. When we come back from a break, we're going to expand beyond the single military example to talk about following orders in most of our lives. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Our discussion will include those peculiar people who decide to disobey orders in a way, whistleblowers. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how we decide when it's right to obey authority, to follow orders. If you've ever decided not to follow an order or thought about it and then changed your mind, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Before the break, we were talking about the military. Joining us now to discuss how authority affects other organizations is Tom Devine, legal director at the Government Accountability Project, a nonprofit, nonpartisan whistleblowers support group. He's also the author of Whistleblower Survival Guide, Courage Without Martyrdom, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks.
Your organization provides support for whistleblowers. These are people who decided not just to disobey an order, but to protest it, really.
Yes, and for civilian employees, the Whistleblower Protection Act officially has the right to refuse to obey an order to violate the law.
These are government employees.
For government civilian workers. Unfortunately, it might as well be the same as in the military. Since that right was created in 1989, there's not a single instance of a federal employee being able to enforce it.
What kind of, we heard about the possible penalties for not obeying orders in the military. If you're a civilian employee of the government, what's the worst they can do? Fire you?
The usual charge would be insubordination. If an agency is afraid that you'd be able to defeat that because the order was so crudely illegal, they might just transfer you to bureaucratic Siberia, isolate you, strip your duties away from you, refuse training so that you gradually become obsolete. There's the variety of harassment tactics is limited only by the imagination. The constant is that these laws don't work. Even if you wanted to just disclose, blow the whistle on an order to violate the law, you don't have a fighting chance to defend yourself. The Whistleblower Protection Act was unanimously passed by Congress, was the strongest free speech law in history on paper. But since it was unanimously strengthened in 1994, the court that has a monopoly on judicial review has only backed whistleblowers one time in 85 decisions. It's almost never relevant. If you're blowing the whistle in the course of doing your job, if you are reporting up the chain of command, if anyone has ever raised the issue before, you don't have free speech rights as a government worker. It's a bad joke, and it's being reinforced by an unprecedented wave of gag orders in this administration. We're at a real showdown. And Congress is on the verge of actually restoring some credible rights for people who don't want to violate the law or who want to have the right to commit the truth, as we call it. Hmm. Senator Collins, the chair of the Senate Government Affairs Committee. Susan Collins of Maine, and Tom Davis of the House Government Reform Committee are both deciding whether to move legislation that will restore credible free speech rights for people who want to protest government illegality.
I assume some people get into contact with your groups and others before they make the jump if they decide to. What do you tell them before they decide to blow that whistle?
We tell them their life will never be the same again. This is a crossroads decision where they're going to have to choose between valid but conflicting values of whether they're going to be team players or stand up for their own values, whether they're going to risk the brand of being a squealer or whether they're going to be a see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, I see nothing sort of person, whether their primary loyalties are to their co-workers in their organization or whether it's to the law in the communities that are affected by breakdowns in organizations, by illegality by the organizations where they work. It's one of those decisions where a person decides, what values are I going to live and what values am I just going to pay lip service to? Hmm.
Let's get another caller on the line. Beth is with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to relate a situation in Austin. I was a special ed teacher with a high school, and there were some severely cognitively impaired young adults there. And the culture of the special ed department was to exploit these children. Some of the aides would eat their lunches while the children sat there, eat the children's lunches. And
you're kidding.
No. And there was a culture of, this special ed classroom is for the adults, not for the students who were there. And I came in as a new person, and I faced a lot of animosity and evil looks when I would try and let them know that this program and this school exists for these children.
Mm-hmm.
The worst of it came when I saw out my window an aide pull a child, an 18-year-old boy, to his feet by the ear. And at that point, after reporting it to the administration and getting, well, we'll look into this, this was the last week of school, and I called the police. I just thought, my school's not doing enough. I need this to stop. And this woman had to be fired. and they were going, you know, I had to be escorted out to my car because there were threats by these other aides that I was in danger. And it was, I felt terrible. She had a family to support. She was a single woman with children, but I couldn't sleep at night. I felt that these people with the least amount of support needed someone who was going to stand up for their rights. And I also feel that that's how we have to feel about our prisoners, whether they're in our country or any other country, that we show our best side when we take care of those who have the least ability to speak for their own rights.
What happened to you?
I ended up moving to Chapel Hill, where I am working. I'm taking a year off, and I'm going to jump back in and continue, I hope, to speak for what's right, because...
But Tom Devine's point about your life will never be the same.
Never. Now I feel like I know. I have clear vision about what is right, and I don't think I'll ever have ambiguity in my mind again.
Hmm.
It has helped me become a stronger person.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Tom, is there a common thread amongst people who decide, like Beth, to speak out or not to speak out?
Yes, there is. It's there are people, whether their motives are noble or base, there are folks who no longer can be true to themselves. They can't accept sitting on some information that they've learned about, keeping it to themselves. They have to follow through and act on some knowledge, whether they wanted to originally or not, whether they were looking for trouble. It would be haunting them. It would be like a cancer eating them up inside if they didn't release this and get it to people who could have an impact, make a difference.
Thank you very much. Tom Devine is the author of The Whistleblower's Survival Guide, Courage Without Martyrdom, and legal director of the Government Accountability Project. He was with us here in Studio 3A. In 1961, Stanley Milgram conducted his famous psychology experiment to examine why people choose to obey. Penina Glaser co-authored a book in direct opposition to Milgram's study, looking at what compels ordinary people not to follow orders. Her book is The Whistleblowers, Exposing Corruption in Government and Industry. She's also a history professor at Hampshire College, and she joins us by phone now from her office in Massachusetts. And nice of you to join us today.
I'm happy to do so.
So just following on the point we were talking about there with Tom Devine, why do ordinary people decide not to follow orders?
Well, there are a couple things to be said about that. First, I want to say that, following on what Tom said, that most people don't immediately jump forward and expose corruption or unethical or illegal behavior.
Not a spur-of-the-moment decision.
It's not a spur-of-the-moment decision. It's something they really agonize about, and many of the people we spoke to took as long as 1 to 2 years to do it. First, they approach their superior, and they're quite certain that somebody's going to correct this.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're slapped down, they go to the superior, and hope against hope, because they believe in their organizations, that somebody's going to see that something terrible is going on. When we ask them, why did you do it? Finally, why did you do it? Because of the great risks that Tom Devine described. They often said one of three reasons. Either, my religious values are so strong that I simply had to obey a higher authority, or my professional values didn't allow me to do that. I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm a military person.
Mm-hmm. I have my own code of ethics or a professional code of ethics.
And I was trained in a particular way, and I couldn't violate the ethics of that profession. Or thirdly, some people just said, what was going on was so dangerous to my community that I simply could not sit still any longer. And so those were generally, in one form or another, the three reasons that you heard over and over again, irrespective of mm-hmm. the particular organization in which the person worked.
Well, Tom was telling us some of the repercussions possible for government workers. I assume not all of these people were in government. What kind of penalties did they face?
Well, you know, there are even fewer protections if you're in private industry. So you can be fired, obviously. You can also easily be blacklisted in an industry so
mm-hmm.
that it's very difficult to get another job. You can be isolated, so that we had an instance of a psychiatrist who's put in a room and told to file all day long for 8 hours a day while patients outside were desperately needing
Therapy, yeah.
Professional work. You can be humiliated in front of your colleagues and your community. So there is a very broad range of retaliatory actions that people can bring. But what's interesting is that often for these people, it only strengthens their resolve. And that's, I think, what we heard from the young woman who was the special ed teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes them even more determined to go forward.
Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Ruth, who's with us from Burnsville, North Carolina.
Yes. Back in 1991, I was working in my area of training at a university in New England. I was a technician, and I had two work-study students working for me. I was asked by my first-line supervisor, ironically, who was politically liberal, to violate 1930s-era wage and hour laws. I was asked to have the work-study students work more than 40 hours per week mm-hmm. without paying them overtime. I refused to do so. I had a conversation with our departmental secretary, who is a very sweet lady in her 50s. She's now retired. And she said that that's really not right. And ironically, she was a very sweet, traditional lady. And I absolutely agreed with her. I refused to have those students work overtime. Instead, I tried to take on some of their job responsibilities. This all happened during the period of a summer. Basically, I was fired from the job in large part, partly because I refused to have those kids work overtime without paying them overtime. I knew about the 40-hour week. I knew that was illegal.
And there was you were fired in such a way as you couldn't take them to court for firing you for doing something that was illegal.
I don't think that I was able to take them to court because what she did, she wrote the supervisor that fired me wrote an extremely scathing 10-point
performance review
of myself. The only good point, which said, Ruth works very hard. Mm-hmm. And that was the only good thing she had to say. And yet I had been verbally, not on paper, but I had been verbally asked to have those non-supervisory work-study students work more than 40 hours per week without paying overtime. The excuse being...
Ruth, we want to get on to other people. I wanted to ask you a very quick question.
Yes. What,
was it worth it?
I don't know because it's hurt my career.
Did you ever think about exposing this situation outside the university to the press or to some other...
I tried exposing it in conversations with other colleagues in similar fields at that university, but it was a very ironic situation
mm-hmm.
because this was a politically liberal department,
mm-hmm.
and it was very embarrassing for them that one of their colleagues was trying to violate wage and hour laws, and very few people listened to me.
Right.
Well, Ruth, thank you for the call, and sorry for what happened to you.
Thank you. Bye.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And Penina Glazer, is it accurate to say that there is a couple of years ago a change in how corporate whistleblowers are protected?
Well, there are certain areas in which corporate whistleblowers have some protection. For example, in the nuclear industry, that's a protected field. But there are still many areas where in the private sector there's relatively little protection,
mm-hmm.
Legal protection for whistleblowers. So when they step forward, they take a certain amount of risk with them. I did want to say, though, that of the people we studied, there were very, very hard times, but most of the people were ultimately able to recreate their careers, and virtually all of them said, when we asked them, would you do it again? They said, oh, my God, it was so hard. It was harder than we ever thought it was going to be. But if I saw that situation again, I would have no choice. I would go forward.
Let's talk now with Dan, and Dan's with us from Sacramento, California.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to tell my story. I had been working at a retail store about 5 years ago, and my employer decided to apply a chemical to the concrete around the store during business hours rather than after, which would have been the logical thing to do. Anyway, the chemical had large amounts of xylene in it, which most people know is fairly dangerous to have in a public place. And I complained about it, and I told my supervisor I was not going to work in that environment, and many of my fellow employees were becoming ill and getting headaches, and customers were complaining, and we ended up going to the back of the store to the break room, and my supervisor found us and told us to go back to work, and I refused. And he said, well, if you won't go back there, and then you just go home. And so I did. And the next day I found out that my supervisor decided not to apply the chemical and do it after hours. And I was not terminated, and I found that my supervisor had a lot more respect for me after that. And we have a very good relationship today.
Hmm.
Great story.
And that does happen, I guess, from time to time.
Yes, it does.
Living example.
Yes.
Well, well done, Dan.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate it. I wanted to end with this email we got from Julie Quater in San Anselmo, California. When my niece was 9 and commuting to a magnet school, she and her 11-year-old brother were held on a bus by an angry school bus driver and not allowed to get off to meet her connecting bus. All the children remained seated in spite of the fact that they would not be able to get to school if they didn't get off the bus. After a few minutes, my niece grabbed her older brother by the hand and stormed off the bus. My sister realized that she had taught her children to do as they're told by adults but had never explained that the exception was when an adult tells them to do something they know is not right. I've learned to teach my own children to respect people in authority, but they are morally responsible to refuse to comply when asked or ordered to do something they know is wrong, which is, I guess, the subject that we've been talking all hour about. Panina Glaser, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Panina Glaser is co-author of The Whistleblowers, Exposing Corruption in Government and Industry, also a professor of history at Hampshire College. She was with us by phone from her office in Massachusetts. When we come back from a break, we're going to be switching subjects. On Monday, we're going to take our radio out of town, but we're going to be talking really about the upcoming fall television season. So give us a call if you're curious about what kind of television program you think you're going to see next fall. 800-989-8255. This is NPR News.